I'm certainly enjoying reading the essays. And as I was reading them, a couple of days ago, I saw an article in the New York Times. I don't know if you saw that. New York lacks money to buy land. It's 22,000 acres up in the Adirondacks.
I did see that article. Yeah, I did see that article.
Now, the governor is opposed to any continued effort to purchase it because the state is out of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, and it's owned by the International Paper Company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to believe that so much land exists privately held today.
Well, there is a lot more in on the East Coast and in New England, of course, large blocks of privately held land than there are in the West. The West is public lands, the Western states. Very, very different situation. In fact, the American public as a whole doesn't realize the difference between being a public land state and being a private land state. But one of the main facts of our life out in the West is that a large percentage of the lands are public lands, which means they belong to all of us. They're people's lands. We don't have this kind of problem in the West because it's already either in BLM or it's in the U.S. Forest Service. But here, with a longer history of private land ownership, the strategy for getting hold of that is to work through some outfit like the Trust for Public Land and the Nature Conservancy, which is a very creative way of holding land until public funds are available for it. And I imagine that somebody is working on that right now, is to try to have an interim holding company to hold it ultimately for the public benefit.
I've seen so much devastation of the landscape in my 50 years growing up in Ohio and Kansas and places like that. The suburban areas that I grew up in are part of the city now, and there used to be forest and streams and lakes. I grew up also in Houston, Texas. There was a buffalo. There was a bio called the Braeswood Bio. And it was not far from my father's house, and we could walk to the bio, and it was a narrow stream that sometimes would swell up in rainy periods. And I noticed last time I was in Houston, that bio is still there, but they put it in a culvert, a concrete culvert.
Mm-hmm.
They channeled it where they wanted to go, and all around it are houses.
Yeah.
Land is cheap in Texas, and they just, instead of using what they have to rebuild older on top of older buildings, they just go further and further out. And yet, I was driving up the New York State Thruway some time ago, and I would come to a high point, and I would look out and see these mountains just stretching almost endlessly in pure green, so green it was black. And I thought, God, there's nothing out there. But there was. I mean, once you get into the mountains, you can see the signs of people.
And every bit of that land has been accounted for.
It has been what?
Accounted for.
Yeah.
It is all surveyed. It's got a brass cap corners set, in the section corners and then the township corners. It's all marked off in ownership grids in the county courthouse. The land title companies know where everything is. And even more striking is the fact, I've just been reading William Cronin's book on the environmental history of New England. It's called Changes in the Land. That was all clear-cut and logged, by the early 19th century, or even into the 18th century. All those trees have grown back. And New England was clear-cut at one point. For gunpowder, for sulfur, for tanning hides, for fuel, for lumber. An extraordinary clear-cutting took place in pre-modern times. And then about a century ago, it started coming back.
There is hope. There is rebirth.
There is rebirth, but it may not be of the same quality. These forests here, my understanding is, could take that kind of impact two or three times over. Two or three times it could survive possibly being clear cut, and then it would reproduce itself. Our California hillsides, with a much drier climate and with a long summer drought, Mediterranean-type climate, the forests could be destroyed and lost forever, and may well happen. This is a big issue out in the West that I'm involved in, because when you clear cut, and then you get this dry, friable, baked soil in the summertime, and then you get a sudden winter rain, you have a lot of erosion. You lose a lot of soil before you get your second round of trees coming in, And the second round of trees will be degenerated. You know, the larger trees, some of the richer trees won't be able to take on that drier soil, that more thinner soil, that droughtier soil. And so that's what happened in the Mediterranean. Greece, the Italian uplands, the Sicilian uplands, were once beautifully forested in pine and oak, as we know from historical reconstruction. They were destroyed from the 5th century BC onwards. And today the people who live there don't even know that they once had wonderful forests. Mm-hmm. So it can be lost. It won't come back if it goes on too long.
Do you consider yourself an environmental activist?
Yes.
In the way that Edward Abbey, the late Edward Abbey, was telling mm-hmm. me just a few months before his death that mm-hmm. he was really an activist to the point where he would sabotage bulldozers and this sort of thing.
Well, I'm really an activist. But I don't think that sabotaging bulldozers is necessarily the most productive way to be an activist. I think there are many levels, many angles on which to work. And you choose the methods according to who you're working with or against. Like working with public lands managers, with the National Forest people and the Bureau of Land Management people, you don't have to sabotage things. You just have to get information which is better than their information. And have better maps, better forest ecology information, understand how their computer programs work and where the flaws in their own programs are, and then go critique them. And they can be instructed. They can turn around their policies sometimes. That's actually what's beginning to happen now on the West Coast and in the Pacific Northwest, where the Forest Service is undergoing quite a reform. After 15 years of public pressure, they're finally responding. So there are many ways to work.
Well, you also have another way, don't you, through your writing?
That paves the ground. That doesn't crack through the bureaucratic shell, though. The bureaucratic shell is cracked through by crunching numbers together with them. You put heads together and crunch numbers, and you have to come up with better numbers than they've got.
Well, I'm a little confused when you're talking about number crunching in terms of saving the environment. Exactly how does that apply?
This applies in the area of public lands management.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of technical stuff. You know, you won't want to use any of this in your day, but just for your information. The national forests, which are enormous and are very controversial because lumber companies want to get in after the trees, but there are other interests, including the welfare of the public as a whole over the next 1,000 years, which wants to have forests into the future. Those are managed with numbers. Those are the forest plan computer program. Vast amounts of statistics are fed in. How many million board feet are growing annually in this forest, in this species? And it didn't used to be that way. 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't that way. But now forest management is done with computers and it's done with numbers. And they will justify a management decision like, we're going to cut X million board feet in that district, in that drainage over the next 5 years. The only way you can fight against that, or resist, no, fight isn't the right word, the only way that you can argue counter to that is, one of the ways is to study their own programming, their own mathematics, which are often terribly flawed, and the assumptions are flawed, and show them that they're off base. That's one of the necessary things. And I have friends who are very good at that, like Randall O'Toole in Eugene, Oregon, who edits, who wrote a book called Reforming the Forest Service. And it's mostly based on very esoteric management policy predictions of this sort, and economic predictions, very complex and esoteric stuff that the citizens are now learning how to do. And having once learned how to do it, they're making headway. The other thing that's new, which is closer to what I can do, is, and it's gradually sinking in not only to the Forest Service but to the public, is the sensitivity and complexity of natural forest ecosystems and the richness and value of full-scale complex ecosystems as against replanted plantations, you know, new forests, all one species, just a plantation. People are beginning to appreciate that a plantation is not the same as a full-fledged forest. It's just not the same quality of life. And then finally, the subtlest issue of all, which is the one that goes to the very roots of our American culture, is the question of, do we value other beings? other than human beings? And if so, how and why? Our society has made a choice to try to protect the spotted owl. It's in the legislation, the Endangered Species Act. This is so interesting. But why the society made that decision, the society itself is not quite sure. It's very hard to make an argument to stop logging on millions of acres of forest lands for the sake of a few owls. On one line, I mean, I'm sure why we should do it. Most people are not very clear about that. And so this is an emerging, a very subtle emerging, almost religious dialogue in American life. The value of other beings other than human beings.
Is that why you're sure? Because the spotted owl has a value as another being?
Well, I have a sense of what that value is, but I certainly do run onto a lot of people who are unclear about what that value is in their own lives and in their own hearts, you know. And who could say, well, hell, we can spare a few owls. You know, after all, the economy's got to keep going. And it's hard to argue against that. Actually, it isn't just the owl. The owl is a signifier for a whole range of creatures that require that kind of habitat. And I feel we have a moral obligation, a deep moral obligation, to keep on living together with the same community we grew up with. That is to say, the community of animals and plants that human beings grew up together with over the last 100,000 years. We have every need, we have every reason and need to keep living together with them. We are part of them, they're part of us. It's our community. It's our neighborhood, you know. All these creatures are part of our neighborhood. We've got no right to trash our neighborhood and exclude them from being part of evolution into the future.
I'd like to touch upon a few of the things in your book of essays, the Practice of the Wild.
Sure.
There's some concepts here that had never occurred to me before. In the first essay, Place, Region, and Commons, you talk about groups being territorial and how even nomads stay within a given boundary.
Right.
I never, when I think of a nomad, I think of Arabs, and they just go and go and go. But as I read the essay, I began to think, the nomadic Arabs don't just go and go, or they would wind up here.
Right.
You know, they actually do stay within a defined region.
Yeah, they have their own territory. Everybody, every tribe, every culture has a territorial limit. There may be a difference as to how much they move around within it, but even the most nomadic nomads move within a certain known route, certain water holes, certain oases, certain places where the grazing is good at a certain time of year. They know where they're going. They have reasons to go there.
I was thinking back in the West in the 19th century when they're tracking down outlaws. The law would often fine them because there were only so many places they could go.
In the arid West.
Yeah, but even though they're talking about a huge geographic area, there were only so many towns, so many saloons, so many places. And I think that's the case now. If there's a criminal, for example, the police stake out the places where that criminal is known to have gone in the past, his friends, his relatives, and so on. So there again, we're talking about territory, people staying within a geographic area.
And known routes, known places, places that you stop. But if you break out of that, it's hard to find you.
Yeah, but most people don't know how to break out.
Who was that fellow from Oregon or from Northern Nevada a few years back, Claude something or other, who was an outlaw hiding out in the deserts of Oregon and Nevada for about 2 years? They finally caught him. He's back in prison again. He was very good as a wilderness man. He went where he hung out where they never thought a person would be, and so he got away with it for a while.
But he slipped somewhere. Huh?
Yeah, he slipped finally.
You wrote a book, I believe, The Turtle Island was
Turtle
the
Island.
Book that you won a Pulitzer Prize for,
yes.
of poems. You discussed Turtle Island as being the original name for America. Can you kind of tell me a little bit about this concept?
That's not literally, necessarily, automatically an original name for North America, but in 1969, when I came back to live in North America, in the Western Hemisphere, after 12 years in Japan, that was just the beginning of the Native American movement and the ecology movement. And I ran onto some Native American friends on the West Coast who announced to me that they were no longer referring to the United States or to North America, that as far as they were concerned, it was going to be called Turtle Island from now on. And I said, well, why? I said, do you know that was always the name or something? They said, no, we don't know if that was always the name. Everybody had different names for it. But there are so many mythologies, creation stories, both from the East Coast and the West Coast, that a turtle plays a big part in. Like getting a little bit of mud from the bottom of the eternal ocean. And with that little bit of mud, they start making some land. And that land becomes where we live now. There's a lot of stories like that. So they said, we're going to call it Turtle Island. Because any name that comes from here is going to be better than America. America was some guy who never got here. So it's an educational exercise in sort of bringing us up short and making us realize that this is an old continent that must have its own name. And names applied to it by recent European visitors aren't appropriate. So it starts from there.
We're not bad with regard to names, though. I mean, all through the country, including the New York area, we use Indian names.
Native place names? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of native place names. There should be more.
Should I not use the term Indian?
Oh, Native American, Indian. I don't think that there's really a problem with that myself. But yeah, place names are an interesting measure.
I had a guy call me from one of our sister stations asking me how to pronounce Ronkonkoma, which is a town on Long Island. Mm. And an Indian name.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still an Indian reservation on Long Island and a number of Indians.
There's a policy that's been formally adopted in Alaska now, which is to not use Anglo names any longer in new place names for places in Alaska, but to make an effort to find out what the native name is. Because every place in Alaska had a native name, still does. And one of the charming things about Hawaii is all of the names are native names. All of the place names in Hawaii, the Hawaiian Islands. It is very nice.
Now, the relationship between the wild and the sacred, and this was a really interesting essay. Tell me a little bit about how you evolved this concept that wilderness is indeed tantamount to being a sacred entity, if I've interpreted that correctly.
That's from the essay Good, Wild, and Sacred, which came about through many meditations on land use categories, a kind of nitty-gritty politics and thinking that I do in terms of my own environmental work on the West Coast, and thinking about how people talk about land. Actually, it came up during Jerry Brown's tenure as governor of the state of California, when I was chairman of the California Arts Council, appointed by Jerry Brown. And some Indian people came to me because they knew that I was very sympathetic. And they said, we have some sacred lands that are about to be destroyed by development. And I went to Jerry and I said, they have sacred lands. And he said, what category of land use is that, sacred lands? So we joked about that. And then we sat down and talked about it. And then I thought about it more. And I realized, of course, all over the world, people have thought of certain pieces of land as sacred. Church lands, or shrine lands, and so forth. And that we Americans have not quite awakened to the possibility of that as being one of the sorts of lands that we have, although we might think of our cemeteries that way, you know. So I went on into that essay then and researched the anthropology of shrine lands and lands that people consider sacred here and there in the world, like sacred mountains. And I found indeed that that is one of the kinds of landscape that people see in the world. And then I realized that for us Americans, even though we haven't yet quite admitted it to ourselves, our wilderness areas and our national parks are our sacred lands. We treat them as though they were sacred. And they are like our temples, our cathedrals, as much as anything is. So that's what I'm exploring there. Is then what happens if we admit that to ourselves? And say, yes, there are some things that we simply want to leave the way they are. We don't have to come up with some rational explanation for leaving it alone. Maybe the explanation is that we deeply feel better if we leave it alone, and that we leave it that way for our children and our grandchildren, like Grand Canyon, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, when you think about the Grand Canyon, our Old Faithful, you know, they are almost like shrines.
Yeah, they have become sort of secular shrines in the consumer economy.
Mm. You write a lot about your days as a lumberjack. Mm. I guess you were a young man
in my 20s, mid-20s.
Yeah. How did that come about? You grew up in Oregon, right?
Washington and Oregon, and some of my uncles were in the logging camps, and I did work on the edge and around the lumber industry as a kid even. I was out there working with those tools. So later in my 20s, I did timber scaling and forestry work with the Forest Service, and then I worked in lumber camps, chucker setting. So I have a first-hand experience of how a logging show operates, a logging operation operates.
Sounds like dangerous work.
It is very dangerous work. Highest industrial accident rate of any industry in the United States. And I'm very glad that I did it, because as a forester, forest ecologist, environmentalist, I can appreciate how the loggers feel. I can appreciate the actual pleasure that one can take in being a logger. And I don't feel dichotomized or put in an adversarial relationship with the lumber industry. I can look at both sides of the question, and I can try to mediate between the two. And I've done that.
Yeah, there was a term that, and you go into some detail in your book of essays, called choker setter.
Yeah.
Choker setter. All these terms, I had no idea what they meant, but you do a pretty good job of laying them out.
Well, I thought that by reading public ought to learn what that terminology is and get some sense of how it all works. It's pretty heavy and noisy and interesting.
When did you start to write poetry?
Oh, when I was 16, 17. I started mountaineering snow peaks out in the West, and I was so impressed by the experience of high mountains that, naively enough, I thought, I'm going to have to write a poem about this. And that's where I started. Later, I learned more and more about the craft of poetry and so forth, and majored in it.
Isn't it interesting that you come out of the same ground as Raymond Carver, and yet your poetry is so different? I mean, he writes about drunken nights and disillusioned people, and your poetry seems to spring from the earth.
Yeah, I knew Ray. In fact, I knew Ray going back quite a few years. It's a difference in character. I could write about drunken people, too.
Well, in fact, there are some references. There are some references as you steamed around the world and
right.
So forth. I shouldn't completely make that much of a distinction between the two. But still, you have the feeling for the ground and the earth and the tree and trees and so forth in a much more romantic way, if that's a proper term, than Carver.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm happy with the word romantic, because I always think of that as implying sentimentalizing. And I don't think I sentimentalize nature. That's one of the reasons I'm able to write about it as a logger, or able to write poems about the food chain, about how all animals are eating each other. But I certainly do write about nature.
But as you began to write, you had to go seek a higher education. I mean, you
might
be a logger and a poet.
Oh, no, I put myself through college by doing that kind of thing. When I was working as a logger, I was also a graduate student in Chinese and Japanese and reading the Chinese classics. I took my lumber camp savings and went back down to Berkeley and went back into reading classical Chinese again. That's not uncommon in the West.
You spent 12 years in Japan, didn't you?
Yeah.
Because you write a lot about Zen. Do you consider yourself a Zen Buddhist? Well, you're not. I think, as you write somewhere in the book, you're not completely a Zen Buddhist, but you practice a great deal of it.
Well, I'm about as much a Zen Buddhist as anybody would want to be.
Well, tell me about that. I've tried to learn a little bit about it and have not been successful. One of my friends is Howard Fast,
uh-huh.
who is a Zen Buddhist. And in fact, he has a detective hero who is a Zen Buddhist detective.
You mean Howard Fast, my old hero? Novelist?
Yeah, the novelist.
Oh,
you didn't know that, Howard?
I knew Howard back from the days when I was at Reed College doing left-wing activism, but I didn't know he had become a Zen Buddhist.
Oh, he is definitely a Zen, and so is his son, Jonathan.
Well, gosh, we've evolved along similar lines.
Yeah, and as I say, he's got a private eye who is a Zen Buddhist detective, probably the only one.
I'm going to have to pick up that and read it. Well, what's your question about Zen?
Well, it's not really a religion, is it? And not being a religion, it still shapes one's life. And how has your life been affected by it, and how do you apply it? Both a writer and an environmental activist.
Well, first I'll say I think Buddhism and Zen which is part of Buddhism, really is a religion. Certainly in East Asia. In Asia, people feel it's a religion. It might not fit all of the criteria that Occidentals have of religion, because it doesn't have a major theological divinity figure. But culturally and spiritually, it is all-embracing. It has a whole culture and a whole history, and it has spiritual practices, basically meditation practices, and ways of teaching those practices that make it very much a religion. And it has a spirit of devotion also. It's not just some kind of secular self-help therapy. It goes very deep into the mind. So I do think of it as a religion, though it's definitely a non-Occidental religion. And it has a practice which is sitting still and meditating for at least half an hour every day, and carrying with you an attitude of mindfulness and attention and a kind of non-judgmental openness towards all of the things in the world as you go through the day. And as its result, it has the fruits of that seem to be, and I've seen it in others as well as in myself, a considerable joy and appreciation for the world just as it is, even as flawed and as imperfect as it is. It is pretty delightful. I'm afraid that's what happens to you when you're a Zen Buddhist.
Sounds like an awful lot of work to apply.
No more work than anything else. I mean, sitting still for half an hour, you call that hard work?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I have the capacity to sit still for a half an hour.
Oh, people do it without even being aware of it, actually. You know, and cats do it all the time. The animals are great Buddhists. They're always meditating.
Well, cats sleep two-thirds of their lives.
Well, you know, they say the difference, this is a Chinese saying, the difference between Buddhists and Taoists. Buddhists meditate, Taoists take naps. So, you know, I know I have a lot of friends who are Taoists.
Are you still teaching?
I teach at the University of California at Davis.
And what are you teaching exactly?
I'm in the English department. We have a creative writing program, so I teach poetics and poetry writing to graduate students. And then I also teach a number of other courses for the English department as a whole. I teach one called the Literature of Wilderness.
Literature of what?
Of Wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
American Nature Writing. I teach the history of the rise of West Coast poetry in the Beat Generation. I teach Chinese and Japanese poetry, Zen Buddhism, and American writing, and things like that, things that I know about.
Do you live near Davis?
100 miles.
And so you have described your house to a certain degree. And
yeah, when I'm teaching, like I will be next month, I have to go down to Davis and stay a couple of nights. I don't try to commute.
Would you consider yourself one of the last remaining Beats? Were you part of the Beat poets?
In some sense, I was. Some history books call me Beat, and other history books call me part of the San Francisco Renaissance. It doesn't matter. I was very close with some of those leading Beat writers. I was already a writer at the time that I first met Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and others. I was already doing my own work. But they were a very lively and inspiring influence also. And as it turned out, we were at that little historical moment, we were all together in the Bay Area launching new poetry readings, launching and arguing our new, more open, more populist, more accessible poetics, arguing against the Eisenhower era and taking a dissident stand in regard to environment and politics in all sorts of ways. And so, sure, we made a little bit of a change at that point in the culture's own sense of itself.
Well, the question arose because I had always grouped Ferlinghetti with the Beats, and he insists he was never a Beat. He was of that generation, but he himself was not, he insists, a Beat a poet.
It's a matter of definition, that's all.
But I think he's going to be grouped with him whether he likes it or not.
I'm afraid he is, or in something. It's something called the New American Poetry. It's somewhere in between what is called in the, you know, there's a book now called the San Francisco Poetry Renaissance by Michael Davidson. It's very good. And Michael tends to use the term the New American Poetry, and then say part of that is what we shall call the Black Mountain Poets, Part of that is what we shall call the Beats. Part of that is the West Coast poets. And part of that is the New York group.
How does one get a poem published, anyway? Where does one publish poetry today? Obviously, I know from talking to poets that they're not going to make a living, but they're going to do it anyway and seek to have their poems published, and they do. But how does an average person get a... I've set out hundreds of poems over the years. I have yet to see one of my poems in print. How does one do it?
Is that a fact? Well, you should just print it yourself and publish it yourself. Send it out in some tiny edition. You're not using a Xerox machine.
Exactly. I have a laser printer, and I have a Macintosh, and I print little editions of 10 copies each, numbered, right. And I give them away to friends. And
that's
publish.
Exactly how poets are getting published nowadays. A lot of young people are self-publishing or starting their own little tiny magazines and publishing themselves and their friends for fun. You know, the original tiny magazine is still alive and well. People keep making them. What I tell my students, who are young poets, I say, go to one of the really good bookstores that carries a whole lot of poetry magazines, one of the really literary bookstores. Look through all those different poetry magazines. Read, sketch through them, skim through them. See which of those seem to be in harmony with what you think and do, that you would like to be in. Write down those addresses and submit poems to those magazines. Don't just try to hit the whole field. But in a sense, you owe it to yourself to become acquainted with what other people are doing before you try to launch yourself out there to be published too. So then you find your own natural circle of comrades. That's practical advice.
Yeah, writing poetry, it would seem to me, although I'm just a dabbler, but it seems to help my own ability to see myself and the things around me I think about it all the time. We all do. I mean, walk down the street and we think about somebody or some incident or some injury, some insult or some happiness, and then it flutters away. But when you write it down, it's there, and you can retain it, you can remember it, and you can call it up again.
Mm-hmm. And poetry is, in that way, it can be a very useful, powerful thing for just one person and his small circle of friends. It's an interesting thing about poetry. It need not have a mass audience or even a large audience. It can be something we just do for ourselves or for a circle of friends. You know, the great Chinese poets, Wang Wei, Du Fu, Li Bo, Ba Zhui, and so forth of the Tang Dynasty, people that are now considered some of the greatest poets in the world, basically they just wrote poems as part of their correspondence with each other. A little circle of friends, 500 or 600 people who had been through the same educational system and were working for the government in the bureaucracy, assigned to different portions of the empire, and they would keep in touch with each other. There wasn't any publishing in those days. But that correspondence and those poems that exchanged back and forth, people would talk about each other's poems. So-and-so sent me this great poem, copy it out and pass it on to somebody else. And so their reputations were built on that.
What was it like the day they announced that you had won the Pulitzer Prize?
I was up in the garage working on my Jeep truck and in the woods out there where I live. And a neighbor turned up and said, have you heard the news? And I said, what news? And he said, you've gotten the Pulitzer Prize. And I said, oh, I wonder what that means. And then I went back to work on my truck. I didn't really have a very clear picture of what it might mean or anything. In fact, I didn't have a picture of what it meant for about 10 years.
Oh.
No, I really didn't.
Had to sink in somewhere.
No. What I mean is the effects of having a Pulitzer Prize didn't become aware of them for about 10 years. Eventually, I realized that in the United States, people really do judge you by what external signs of accomplishments you have. And I finally realized I was getting a little measure of extra respect when I went out in the world, simply because of that. But I hadn't quite noticed it for some time. It didn't become clear to me for a while. And the other effect was that I noticed that newspapers no longer referred to me as beatnik poet, but they started referring to me as Pulitzer Prize winning poet, which I thought was a plus.
But it's something else, too. It's an endorsement of the things that you had worked.
Well, what I'm saying is that I didn't realize that the endorsement was actually that good an endorsement or that taking that seriously by the world at large. I mean, I was just sort of naive. I'd lived out of the country for many years, and then I was working in my own mountain neighborhood developing a farmstead. And I was working very hard at writing, but paying very little attention to where my reputation in the world at large was. And so I just wasn't thinking about it. And finally, I realized that I had a literary career that I hadn't even particularly thought about.
Looks good on your resume, too. Well, the lamented North Point Press, you know, I'm so sorry to see that they're going to stop their publication, but at least you got in under the wire with the publication of your new book of essays, The Practice of the Wild, and the republication of Rip Rap and Coal Mountain Poems. I wonder if it would be possible if you could read one of the poems in the book.
Certainly, from Rip Rap?
Yeah.
Sure.
There are several poems I like particularly. Maybe, unless you have a particular...
If you have a choice, tell me, Don.
Let's see. Well, I do like For a Far-Out Friend, even though it does have the term snatch in it, but maybe I could slip that under the wire.
I'd rather not read that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You give us a selection.
Let me read the first one, which registers in its own way my study of Chinese classics and the influence that came to me from reading Chinese poetry. Written when I was working in the North Cascades, just south of the Canadian border on a lookout. Mid-August at Sourdough Mountain Lookout. Down valley a smoke haze, 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch close on the fir cones, across rocks and meadows, swarms of new flies. I cannot remember things I once read. A few friends, but they are in cities. Drinking cold snow water from a tin cup, looking down for miles through high, still air.
Yeah, that's a very, very nice poem. Maybe one more. I like the one on page 12 a lot.
Okay. Water. Pressure of sun on the rock slide whirled me in dizzy hop and step. Descent. A pool of pebbles buzzed in the juniper shadow. Tiny tongue of a this-year rattlesnake flicked. I leaped, laughing for little boulder color coil. Pounded by heat, raced down the slabs to the creek, deep tumbling under arching walls, and stuck whole head and shoulders in the water, stretched full on cobble, ears roaring, eyes open, aching from the cold, and faced a trout.
Very nice. Well, I wanted to talk to you for a long time. I'm glad I had this opportunity, and I certainly was not disappointed. Gary Snyder, thank you very much.
Thank you.